Yes, and welcome to Dhammaloka's Sutta Exploration session. And today we're doing a sutta, numbers 126. It's the Bhumija Sutta. Very straightforward sutta. You have to know too much Pali for this. And as probably most of you probably know by now, my approach to the Dhamma, in terms of the sutta anyway, it's mostly for inspiration, not too much for clarification. I'm not really a doubting character. I read just to fuel my practice of meditation, inspire me in the Dhamma, really. And in terms of the more subtle Dhamma, I think, you know, that's to be experienced in the mind, from peace, really. The thing to remember is that the Dhamma, I think, is simple, but very profound and very sublime. And a common mistake some of us make is that because we think if something's complicated, then it must be right. You know, we can't understand something, then it must be really, really profound. But I think the Dhamma, as the way I understand it, is quite simple. It's not how much you know, but it's how far it sinks in. You know, if you penetrate the Four Noble Truths, that's all you really need. And the Four Noble Truths are very, you know, straightforward, you know. The truth that there's suffering, and then the cause of suffering, and that's mainly craving. And it's to understand that in terms of our own experience, what is craving, you know, what is suffering? To know that when it comes up, to know that in the present moment. Right? To really understand, once we penetrate to that, then, you know, then we become, you know, in the stream. Okay? So a test of wisdom is not how many books you can write, but actually how peaceful your mind is. And then that's why this path is more of an internal path. Only you yourself know how peaceful you are. We all can get up here and say very profound things, but it's only in our own mind so I know how peaceful we are. And that's why it's hard to know, you know, who is really peaceful or not, because it's only on your own, it's only an internal thing, a solitary thing that we know. And that's why sometimes honesty, self-honesty is very important on this path. To admit that we have defilements when it comes up, but then also to get on with it. Right? Right. No, but you can reflect, you know, like, you know, before you go to bed or something, say, oh, you know, what things can I remember I've done today? Or sometimes just reflect, the thing I reflect is that when you get angry, then you know, okay, I'm missing the point, you know, there's some craving somewhere here. Like get angry, get disappointed, get annoyed. It doesn't have to be very coarse, like, you know, an outright outrage or something. It could be subtle annoyances of different people, whatever. And it's like, okay, there's kind of little expectations that come up, how people should behave. When they don't do what you want, you get annoyed. And you realize, okay, well, you know, it's a bit silly of me. Because there's always people who do their own things. And there are always people who, you know, who do annoying things. It's the nature of social interactions. And don't get people to do exactly what you want all the time. And so little things like that, you say, okay, that's an expectation I have. And if you have expect something from other people, then, you know, when we take it to be true, then we suffer. Because people will disappoint us from time to time. But like I said, in the beginning, just kind of recognize it, kind of on reflections during the day. Then when your mindfulness becomes more stronger or steadier, you can see it, you know, faster and faster. Okay? I think initially it's more of a reflection. Okay, what did I do today? But then, as you know, like he says, you know, the meditation becomes deeper. Then it's a knowing. Okay, this is the right thing. You catch it faster. It's, you know, catch it at 9:40 instead of waiting until 7 o'clock at night when you get angry at 9:30. Yeah. It's more of a physical sensation. You, oh, okay. Like I was saying the other day on the Dhamma talk, that, you know, there is a physical manifestation of all our emotional states. If you're in tune to how the body feels, then you know very quickly. You're angry or happy or anxious or nervous. Because it manifests in the body somewhere. A tightness of the shoulder, your jaw muscles, around the eyes. And once we become more sensitive, we can see it comes up right away. Oh, really? Oh, okay. Yeah, it's true. I mean, whatever works, but it's true. Yeah, that's also a good, valid point. Yeah. You see, you tend towards, okay. Sometimes we get caught with, you know, said, okay, so-and-so is doing this to me, annoying things again. Then we get run away with it. And before you know, you realize, okay, you're kind of breathing very shallowly, very quickly or something. Comes up. Okay. So we're off to Sutta 126. There's interaction between Venerable Bhumicha and Prince Jayasena, which the footnote says is his nephew. Okay, thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove, the squirrel sanctuary. Then, when it was morning, the Venerable Bhumicha, dressed and taking his bow and outer robe, went to the house of Prince Jayasena and sat down on a seat made ready. Then Prince Jayasena went to the Venerable Bhumicha and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down on one side and said to the Venerable Bhumicha, "Master Bhumicha, there are some recluses and Brahmins who make such assertions and hold such views as this. If one makes an aspiration, and one leads the holy life, one is unable to procure any fruit. One makes no aspiration, and one leads the holy life, one is still unable to procure any fruit. If one both makes an aspiration, and makes no aspiration, and one leads the holy life, one is still unable to procure any fruit. If one neither makes an aspiration, nor makes no aspiration, and one leads the holy life, one is still unable to procure any fruit. What does the Venerable Bhumicha's teacher say here? What does he declare?" I think this is basically one of the six views, wrong views, the Buddha said, that's around as current in his time. It's a view that no matter what you do, things are predetermined. You have no influence over the course of the future. It doesn't matter what you do. Things will turn out the way they are. And that's one of the wrong, it's one of the one wrong views that was prevalent around the time of the Buddha. And then the Venerable Bhumicha goes on to kind of tells Prince Jayasena at the law of karma that, there is results, there is conditionality. You want results, you have to put in the causes that bring about these results. And the fruits of the holy life, as you find out, we'll find out later, is the Eightfold Path. You have the right view, you have the right thoughts, the right intention, and it goes all the way to right concentration. Then you can procure the fruits of the holy life. But you have wrong view to begin with. Then it also conditions the Eight Noble Path in the wrong way. Right? So fairly straightforward, I think. Okay, so Venerable Bhumicha replies to Prince Jayasena, "I have not heard and learned from the Blessed One's own lips, Prince, but it's possible that the Blessed One might say this. If one makes an aspiration and one leads the holy life unwisely, one is unable to procure any fruit. One makes no aspiration and one leads the holy life unwisely, one still unable to procure any fruit. When both makes an aspiration and makes no aspiration, and one leads the holy life unwisely, one is still unable to procure any fruit. When neither makes an aspiration nor makes no aspiration, and one leads the holy life unwisely, one is still unable to procure any fruit. However, if one makes an aspiration and one leads the holy life wisely, and that's the difference, one is able to procure fruit. One makes no aspiration, and one leads the holy life wisely, one is still able to procure fruit. One both makes an aspiration and makes no aspiration, and one leads the holy life wisely, one is still able to procure fruit. If one neither makes an aspiration, nor makes no aspiration, one leads the holy life wisely, one is still able to produce fruit. I have not heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips, friends, but it is possible that the Blessed One would answer as I have stated. So obviously, as most of you probably know, that the sutta is kind of, you know, was in the days of the Buddha, was written down. It was an oral tradition. So a lot of repetitions is done so that it goes in easier. It's easier to remember. But unfortunately, when you read it out, it tends to be a little bit repetitious, right? And the main thing, the main point he was driving home was that, you know, this Buddhism, the path and fruit, is about conditionality. You have to put in the right causes to get the right result. Whether you sit there and you want, you know, certain things to happen, but you don't put in the right causes, the results are not going to come, whether you wish or not wish. You know, and there's other suttas I will read to complement this from the Anguttara Nikaya regarding, you know, the lawfulness of progress. We want progress. We want peace and happiness. You know, wishing to be peaceful is not the causes to a peaceful mind. We have to put in the right causes, and the causes of a peaceful mind is, in the Buddha said, you know, right intention. You know, intention of letting go, intention of kindness, intention of renunciation. These are the right causes. You know, and the whole Eightfold Path. We want a peaceful mind. We have to kind of always incline towards all those, you know, factors. Right intention, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right stillness. And then peace and happiness comes about. Right? Okay. Any questions up to now? Okay. Going on, paragraph 5. If Master Bhumicha's teacher speaks thus, if he declares thus, then it certainly seems that the Venerable Bhumicha's teacher stands ahead of all the ordinary recluses and Brahmins. Then Prince Chanasena served the Venerable Bhumicha from his own dish of milk rice. Then when the Venerable Bhumicha had returned from his alms round after his meal, he went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, he sat down on one side and told the Blessed One what had occurred, adding, Venerable Sir, I hope that when I was asked such a question and answered thus, I said what has been said by the Blessed One, and did not misrepresent him with what is contrary to fact. I hope I explained it in accordance with the Dhamma in such a way that nothing which provides a ground for censure can be legitimately deduced from my assertion. So this is very nice. You can see that, you know, he said, what he said was very, you know, true and very down the line Dhamma. But out of respect for the Buddha, he went back and reported the conversation and also checked to make sure that he had it right. You know, make sure that he didn't misrepresent the Buddha in any way. Right? So this is a nice little touch of kind of humility from Venerable Bhumicha, I thought. Surely, Bhumicha, when you were asked such a question and answered thus, you said what has been said by me and did not misrepresent me with what is contrary to fact. You explain in accordance with the Dhamma in such a way that nothing which provides a ground for censure can be legitimately deduced from your assertion. Whatever recluses and Brahmins have wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood, wrong effort, wrong mindfulness, and wrong concentration, if they make an aspiration and they lead the holy life, they are unable to procure any fruit. If they make no aspiration and they lead the holy life, they are still unable to procure any fruit. And they both make an aspiration and make no aspiration and they lead the holy life, they are still unable to procure any fruit. They neither make an aspiration and make no aspiration and they lead the holy life, they are still unable to procure any fruit. Why is that? Because that wrong path is not proper method for procuring fruit. Right? Going back to just simple conditionality. You want certain results, you have to put in the right causes. And then Buddha goes on to give very simple, but also very clear similes of what he's trying to get at. Right? Okay. Suppose a man needing oil, seeking oil, wandering in search of oil, were to heap up gravel in a tub, sprinkled it all over with water and pressed it, then he made an aspiration after this, he will be unable to procure any fruit. And he goes on to the four kind of steps regarding making an aspiration or not, and making both or neither. You know, if you want oil and you put gravel in the tub, you're not going to get oil, no matter what you do. No matter, you know, how much you wish for it, how much you or not wish for it, it's not going to come about. Because you can't get oil from, you know, gravel. Right? That's just one simile, you know, just very simple, but it just drives home the point. Second simile is, suppose a man needing milk, seeking milk, wandering in search of milk, would you pull a recently calved cow by her horn? It's a great simile. It's like you want milk and you pull with a horn. Are you going to get the milk? Of course not. It doesn't matter what you do, whether you wish for it or not wish for it, whether you make an aspiration or not, whether you both make and don't make, or whether you don't make, or in anything. So, you know, you want milk, you have to pull something else. The pulling the horn is not going to work. Right? Okay, that's the second simile. Third one, suppose a man needing butter, seeking butter, wandering in search of butter, would you pour water into a churn and churn it with a churning stick? Then if he made an aspiration, made no aspiration, he both made an aspiration, made no aspiration, or he neither made an aspiration, he's still unable to procure any butter. Why is that? Because that way of acting is not proper method for procuring butter. So same thing he says regarding recluses and Brahmins. You follow the wrong eightfold path, you know, you're not going to get any result, whether you make any aspirations or not. Okay? Same with the fire. Suppose a man needing fire, seeking fire, wandering in search of fire, would you take an upper fire stick and rub a wet, sappy piece of wood in it? Then, same combination regarding aspirations, he was still unable to procure any fire. Why is that? Because that way of acting is not proper method for procuring fire. So too, the same thing for recluses and Brahmins. And then he goes to regarding, you know, that's you kind of doing things the wrong way. And then he goes, you know, you want fire, you want path and fruit, you have to do the right way. And whatever recluses and Brahmins have right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness and right concentration, they make an aspiration and they lead the holy life, they are able to procure fruit. Right? And he goes through, they make no aspiration and they lead the holy life, they are still able to procure fruit. They both make an aspiration and make no aspiration and they lead the holy life, they're still able to procure fruit. And why is that? Because that right path is a proper method for procuring fruit. And that's why I think with other suttas, the Buddha also said, you know, some of his disciples said, outside of the Buddhist religion, are there any enlightened beings? Anybody, you know, of the four pairs of enlightened beings? The stream enterer, the once returner, the non-returner, or the arhat. Outside the Buddhist religion, you know, are there enlightened beings? And, you know, this is not kind of, a sectarian view, but he said, you know, whether they're not doesn't depend on whether they're Buddhists or not, but it depends on whether the people from the other religions have the Eightfold Path. They follow, and they do the, you know, they follow and they realize the Eightfold Path, then they'll be, you know, enlightened beings in other religion, as long as they have, you know, they follow the Eightfold Path. It's one of those, you know, Buddhism is based on your actions, not based on what you believe in. And the Buddha never sat down and formulated a religion. He formulated a method, a training method for realizing enlightenment, ultimate liberation. So as long as we follow that path, whether you're Buddhist or not, you know, ultimate liberation happens. You know, then you realize the end of suffering. Right? Any questions or comments? Uh-huh. Right.
That's a very foreign concept for the
people. Well, that's why. Well, that's true. That's very good that, you know, you brought it up first. Well, that is true. Right view is very deep. And you have, and then that's where, you know, associating with wise people bring about, especially Buddhists, the concept of kind of non-self. It's one of the Buddhist contribution to, you know, kind of training. Because, you know, all religion preach a self somewhere, ultimate God, It's a big self. And still, unless, and then you hold a sense of self, but also, I think in the beginning, it's okay to have wrong view in the beginning, but if you meditate deep enough, and you go into the mind, you see that, I think. You know, well, based on what the Ajahn Brahm said, based on what the Thai meditation teacher said, you can see that for yourself. You can see non-self once your meditation is strong enough. So eventually, if you penetrate to that, then you can see for yourself. Even Ajahn Panyawado, who passed away a couple of years ago, English monk living in Thailand, he said the same thing, that even if you're a Christian and you have good enough meditation, and also a discerning mind, and to also question, what is God? You know, who is God and what is God? And you keep reflecting on that, and through deeper meditation, you know, clarity, you see for yourself that, you know, it's actually a more projection of our, and nothing is, everything comes and stays and passes away. And if you kind of extrapolate that, then it's impossible to have an eternal being that way. Yeah. Which one? That's right. That's right, he realized, you know, just through reflection, you know, from daily life, that yeah, there's no ultimate beings. Yeah. Questions or comments? No? Okay, so he just goes on to say that, well, the right thing, on paragraph 15, suppose a man needing oil, seeking oil, wandering in search of oil, were to heat up sesame flour in the tub, sprinkled it all over with water and pressed it. Then, if he made an aspiration after thus, he would be able to procure oil. And he goes through the different combination. If he made no aspiration and after thus, he would still be able to procure oil. If he both made an aspiration and made no aspiration, he would still be able to procure oil. If he neither made an aspiration nor made no aspiration and acted thus. See, the main thing is acting the right way. He would still be able to procure oil. Why is that? Because that way of acting is a proper method for procuring oil. So too, whatever requisites and Brahmins have right view, all the way up to right concentration, they are still able to procure fruit. Why is that? Because that right path is a proper method for procuring fruit. Okay? And goes through the other four simile of kneading milk. Instead of pulling on the cow's horn, you pull her udder. I guess that's where milk comes from. Then, you know, you get milk because you pour in the right thing. And then whether you made an aspiration or not, it doesn't matter because you're doing the right thing. Right? Same with kneading butter. Instead of pouring gravel into it, you pour curd into a churn and then you churn that. And curd is the right process of making butter. And you get butter whether you aspire to it or not aspire to it. Okay. And then he goes to at the end of the suttas. If these four similes had occurred to you with reference to Prince Chanasena, he would have spontaneously acquired confidence in you. And being confident, he would have shown his confidence to you. And then Venerable Bhumicha replies to him, Venerable Sir, how could these four similes have occurred to me with reference to Prince Chanasena as they occurred to the Blessed One, since they are spontaneously and have never been heard before? Which is just the interaction the Buddha always does. And he says, you know, this simile spontaneously occurred to me. And then he asks his disciple, you know, have you thought about it before? And they say, of course not, because it spontaneously occurred to you on the first time. How can we think about it? But it's just one of those, you know, funny things that comes up in the suttas. And then it ends. So basically, like I was saying earlier, just straightforward suttas about conditionality. And we want results, have it put in the right causes. And these results come about. It's not through wishing, and it's the same with our practice. You know, not through wishing to be more peaceful, wishing to be more kind, but just think, yes, these are the things that I would like, but what are the causes, what are the results that brings that about? And it's the same thing, you know, the thing that we can apply through our meditation. Peaceful state of mind does not arise from wishing. And a lot of times, sometimes that's what we do. We sit there and we say, you know, I wish I wouldn't think, I wouldn't, you know, I wasn't thinking too much. I wish all these thoughts in my mind go away. You know, I wish my body would not ache so much. And these subtle things that come up, and that's kind of recognizing that actually, you know, wishing to be peaceful, it doesn't lead to peace. It's, you know, it's the letting go, being at peace with things, leaving things alone, That is the causes for peace in the mind. I'd just like to complement that with the, from the Gucha Nikaya, which is the numerical discourses, also translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi, on the lawfulness of progress, page 238. It's on the chapter of the tens. It says here, for one who is virtuous and endowed with virtue, there is no need for an act of will. May non-remorse arise in me. It is a natural law amongst that non-remorse will arise in one who is virtuous. For one free of remorse, there's no need for an act of will. May gladness arise in me. It is a natural law that gladness will arise in one who is free from remorse. For one who is glad at heart, there's no need for an act of will. May joy arise in me. It is a natural law that joy will arise in one who is glad at heart. For one who is joyful, there's no need for an act of will. May my body be serene. It is a natural law that the body will be serene for one who is joyful. For one who is of serene body, there's no need for an act of will. May I feel happiness. It is a natural law that one who is serene will feel happiness. For one who is happy, there's no need for an act of will. May my mind be concentrated. It is a natural law for one who is happy that the mind will be concentrated. Right? So for concentration, for stillness, you know, it's not by wishing you don't get there. Concentration, you know, stillness of mind becomes when you're happy, the minds become naturally still. Right? It's not from focusing, it's not from wanting, it's not from putting more effort. It's from happiness. It's important to remember that. And for one who is concentrated, there's no need for an active will. May I know and see things as they really are. It is a natural law for one with a concentrated mind to know and see things as they really are. And for one who knows and sees things as they really are, there's no need for an active will. May I experience revulsion and dispassion. Revulsion and dispassion, I think these are the nibbida and, you know, viraga in Pali. Yeah, it's a sense of kind of, some people say, well, it's a bit pessimistic of Buddhism to be revolt from the world. But I think, you know, from a Buddhist perspective, from an enlightened perspective, that, you know, if you see the world as, you know, just a mass of suffering, any, you know, kind of entanglement, distractions, then naturally the peaceful mind will withdraw inside, naturally. Like I said, you know, a famous saying is, you know, what the enlightened one calls suffering, the world says is happiness. And what the enlightened one says is happiness, the world says suffering. So there's always reflection to think about when we get happy about certain things and say, would this be in accordance with what the enlightened beings say? For one who experiences revulsion and dispassion, there's no need for an active will. May I realize the knowledge and vision of liberation. It is a natural law for one who experiences revulsion and dispassion to realize the knowledge and vision of liberation. So this just strikes home again, you know, it's a natural law. We don't need to wish and want, just put in the right causes and they can, you know, and the results happen by themselves. You know, so to reflect on that. And next is the Dhamma in brief. Okay. This is in the chapter of the eighth. Okay. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Waisali in the great wood. In the hall of the peaked roof, the Mahaprajapati Gotami approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him and stood to one side. Standing there, she said to him, this is the Buddha's stepmother who raised him. Okay. It would be good, Lord, if the Blessed One would teach me the Dhamma in brief, so that having heard the Dhamma from the Blessed One, I might dwell alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute. When Gotami, you know of certain things. These things lead to passion, not to dispassion, to bondage, not to detachment, to accumulation, not to diminution, to having many wishes, not to having few wishes, to discontent, not to contentment, to gregariousness, not to seclusion, to indolence, not to the arousing of energy, to luxurious living, not to frugality. Of such things you can be certain, this is not the Dhamma, this is not the discipline, this is not the Master's teaching. So this is kind of very stripped down version of what the Dhamma is. You know, Dhamma always leads to simplicity, not to diversity. Always leads to, you know, fewness of wishes, not to getting more, wanting more. And this is kind of ask the test, reflect on ourselves. Where is our mind inclining towards? You know, getting more, wanting more, being more, or is it inclining the opposite? You know, kind of working to suppress, but restrain the sense of self, working to restrain our desires, you know, working to restrain exposing our senses to different things. But go to me, when you know of certain things, these things lead to dispassion, not to passion. See, in the world, we love to get excited, get passionate about things. You haven't lived unless you found love. That's, you know, kind of a common thing people are always telling you. And it's not, according to, you know, it's not Dhamma, you know, leading to stillness. It's better than getting all worked up over certain emotions and stuff like that. To detachment, not to bondage. To diminution, not to accumulation. To having few wishes, not to having many wishes. To contentment, not to discontent. To seclusion, not to gregariousness. To the arousing energy, not to indolence. To frugality, not to luxurious living. Of such things you can be certain. This is the Dhamma. This is the discipline. This is the Master's teaching. And as one of my favorite students, he says, this is very kind of clear what the Dhamma is and what kind of worldly stuff is. And it's always something to kind of reflect on over and over again. You know, where am I heading? Where's my mind inclining towards? You know, is it towards simplicity or to wanting more things? And the final ones is on chapter 8 again. It's conditions for wisdom. You want to be wise, you want to be peaceful. And these are the things to look for. There are, O monks, these 8 causes and conditions, see, for the obtaining of wisdom fundamental to the holy life when it has not been obtained, and for bringing about the increase, maturation, and fulfillment by development of the wisdom that has already been obtained. 1:8. Here, a monk lives in dependence on the teacher or a certain fellow monk in the position of a teacher, and has set up towards him a keen sense of shame and moral dread, and regards him with affection and respect. This is the first cause and condition for obtaining the wisdom fundamental to holy life. And it's the way also where the Buddha always drive home the point of, you know, friendship, association with the wise. That is the whole of the holy life. Unless and because living with these wise people, you get the right view about what is suffering, what is happiness, the right view about what is permanent and what is impermanent, the right view about no self, what is sense of self and what is no self. And it's just, and then, you know, and associating with the wise teacher leads you, pulls you along the way. And that's the whole of the holy life. Not just how. So it's all on conditionality. The more you're with this teacher, wise person, the more you're just kind of absorbed into his aura, into his way of thinking. And over time, you know, it takes over your kind of thinking. Instead of thinking from a worldly point of view, of wanting and getting more, you begin to think of, you know, of letting go and being at peace and being content with what you have already. Yes? Uh-huh.
There's a lot of people get very confused between inappropriate and inappropriate shame, dread, inappropriate dread, and get all sorts of psychological problems as a result of that. What is the context for the environment that is also appropriate shame to be dread? Because it makes a big deal of it.
He does. That's a good point. Yeah, that's a very good process. Because it is, but moral, you know, the Buddhist kind of perspective on shame and dread, it's not the same as guilt, the Christian kind of version of guilt. You do this, you get be punished. But it's more of, you know, when you do something wrong, when you hurt somebody, say something nasty, you think to yourself, okay, I could have done better. You know, I didn't need to do it. So it's this kind of, really to reflect that, you know, on the law of karma. You do unwholesome act, then you would get that back. So that's why kind of this kind of dread in it, because you know that whatever unwholesome things you've done, that comes back. So that restraint, you're kind of, you're angry, you realize, okay, I'm angry now, I'm not going to make any more bad karma by acting, by saying things I should have, by doing things. And that's where I think the moral shame and dread comes in. You know. And also, with the teacher, yeah, allow, because sometimes you say, okay, as a Buddhist, I shouldn't have any wants, and I shouldn't like anything, I shouldn't enjoy my food. Monks are not supposed to enjoy your food. But you live with Ashram, you know that, you know, he's certainly making big things out of the things he likes. And I think a lot of it is just to kind of overcome all the junior monks' own kind of, worrying that, you know, have this kind of idealization that, you know, as monks, you know, we shouldn't be doing that, shouldn't be doing that. And it leads to a lot of sense of guilt. And you know, Ajahn Brahm always reminds us that unless you are almost enlightened, a non-returner, you're going to have likes and dislikes. You're going to have preferences. You're going to have, you know, sensuality. And that's normal. And that's why living with the enlightened beings, you can see they have certain, you know, preferences, but it's very different from, it's hard to explain, but it's very different from, the ordinary people, how we delight in things. You know, you see, you get an idea more about what desire is and what letting go and what acting out of kindness is. A lot of times we have these ideas in our head, what kindness is, what things is, and we try to measure up to this kind of ideal picture we have in our mind of what we should be. And it's not from experience, it's from just kind of more projection. And then we get into these things that, you know, I'm angry, but now I'm angry for being angry, because now I know I shouldn't be angry. And it just goes around and around, and gets very complicated, and gets very twisted. And that's not what the Dhamma is about. It's the Dhamma is about letting go. And if you are angry, you know, Ajahn Brahm would say, that's okay, you know. Like, you know, if taken out of context, like his advice to monks or something could be, seems very strange. Like one young monk had a lot of problem with lust, his sexual fantasy, sitting in fantasies about, you know, different things, you know, his old girlfriends or whatever. And he was feeling very, very guilty about it. And he came up to Ajahn Brahm and he confessed, you know, I have a problem with, you know, fantasy. And you would think, usually you would think the standard answer would be, you know, just cut it off. You know, you're a monk, what are you doing thinking this, you know, these kind of coarse thoughts? You would think that, you know, from normally you would think that's what Ajahn Brahm would say, you know, just focus on your meditation or something. But Ajahn Brahm said the opposite. He said, never mind, don't worry about it. You know, just see how long you can fantasize about. Just go for it. Because you know, the problem wasn't the monk's, you know, fantasy. I think the problem was the fact that he was beating himself up over it, saying, you know, I shouldn't be doing this, I shouldn't be doing that. So he's adding on top of his own, you know, defilements more. He's adding anger on top of his lust. And it's creating more of a problem. So I think, you know, being a very wise teacher, he said, you know, go for the fantasy and see what happens. And this person, you know, when we hear, it's like, what? He encouraged you to fantasize. What is he doing? I think he's drinking too much coffee or something. But then on reflection, he said, okay, maybe I come from a place of wisdom. So a lot of times when we are, you know, we think that what the answer should be, having read some Dhamma, but actually in experience, it may be something else. So it's only a wise teacher who has the stillness and the clarity to know from moment to moment. And obviously, you know, and he doesn't give the same recommendation to everybody, to know that at that time, in time, you know, at that place in time, with this particular individual, this is the right thing to say. And that's why sometimes we get a lot of tape talks, and taken out of context, it seems very odd or funny, but a lot of times these talks are, you know, directed to a specific audience, in a specific time. So, and a lot of times it's hard to, if you listen to talk, you know, you kind of, if you take out context, it doesn't make sense sometimes. And the other conditions for wisdoms are, as he is living independent on teachers, he approaches them from time to time and inquires, how is this, venerable sir? What is the meaning of this? Those venerable ones then disclose to him what has not been disclosed, clear up what is obscure, and dispel his perplexity about many perplexing points. This is the second cause and condition for obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the holy life. Okay, so this is what discussion the Dhamma, clarifying any doubts you have. Right. Having learned the Dhamma, he dwells withdrawn by way of two kinds of withdrawal of the body and withdrawal of the mind. This is the third cause and condition for obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the holy life. So there's, I mean, you know, sometimes in the fourth tradition, we seem like we're always bagging the scholarly monk. You know, don't study too much, you know. Books are just like menus. You know, if you don't put the menus down, eat the food, you know, before, and you don't put the book down and, you know, and meditate, you won't know what peace is like. And it's like, oh, you're always rubbishing, you know, intellectual thoughts because you guys are not educated. You're a bunch of, you know, kind of country bumpkins, and that's why you always go, rubbishing the scholars. But no, in Buddhism, there is a place for study. It's a starting point. It's just sometimes, you know, some of us make the mistake of just clinging to the books and just reading the books instead of actually seeking inspiration from it and then actually sitting down and putting it into practice. Right? And then that's the important thing in Buddhism, is, you know, to know, to have a good foundation in terms of different Buddhist concepts. But also the main thing is, you know, it's true, peace will only arise from a peaceful mind. So you have to put it into practice. Yeah. But it helps. In the beginning, it's good to get the grounding. Now, it goes into it. He is virtuous, restrained by the restraint of the Patimokkha, perfect in conduct and resort, seeing danger in the slightest faults, having undertaken the training rules, he trains himself in them. This is the fourth cause and condition for obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the holy life. So you can see that's all conditionality. First you learn the Dhamma, and then you perfect your virtue. And virtue, in the Buddhist kind of scheme, is more than just kind of harmlessness. Sila is a combination of kind of harmlessness, not harming other people, not harming yourself, but also in this kind of sense restraint. And it's a higher kind of sila. Because you know that ultimately, all contact in the mind is a disturbance. Any interaction with anybody else or with yourself, any movement of the mind is not desirable. And it's very subtle. So that's what restraint of the mind is. You know, we put everything into our mind. You know, reading on the newspaper, listening to music, watching TV. From a lay perspective, what's so terrible about that? People do it all the time. My monk's such stickler, you know, such neurotic about, you know, not exposing ourselves to the world. You know, it's normal. Yes, in one sense it's normal, but in another, if you're trying to train your mind, these things bounce around in your mind. These things, you know, do not lead to stillness of mind. And in one sense, you're not hurting anybody, obviously, reading a few newspaper. But I think if you're trying to train your mind, you can see very clearly that not only are you wasting the time by exposing your mind to these kind of distractions, even when you sit down, they still bounce around your mind. So you're wasting more time, and you're actually creating the causes for non-stillness. Right? So when you realize that, you said, okay, I'm going to be careful. It's just the same with, you know, with our body. We only want to eat healthy food, because we know that health, you know, fitness, to some extent comes from obviously putting healthy things into our body. It's the same with the mind. A healthy mind, a still mind. It's, you know, you want that, and you have to kind of restrain what goes into it. I think that the Dalai Lama has a good simile, like, you know, a house with six doors, six windows or something. And he has a pile of paper on the table. If you left the window open when he went out to have a walk, and the wind comes through, it's going to blow everything around. And he wants, you know, to have a clean house, where the paper, a nice, neat stack. And he has to keep the window closed. It's the same, the windows are the similes for the six senses. You want a peaceful mind, you have to kind of watch what you expose yourself to. And in these days, you know, it's very easy to expose ourselves to many, many things that, you know, on the surface may not seem so harmful or terrible. But I think if you're trying to still the mind, then it just kind of be, you know, that extra 10% makes all the difference. And like I said, these are kind of, I offer for reflections to try out for yourself, you know, to be more restrained. But from a sense of letting go, not from a force. Don't want you guys to all run home, you know, close your window, roll down up the shutters, and just close your eyes and say, okay, now I want to be peaceful. I'm shutting out my five sense world and see where peace comes from. I think a lot of it, and I'm not going to ever read a newspaper again, because, you know, I want to steal mine. These come gradually. Once you have the sensitivity, you know that, okay, this is not what I want to do. Yeah. No, I think they do trip around, and I think it's the sense we strengthen mindfulness. The more mindful you are, the more restrained you are. And the more restrained you are, the more mindful you are. And you're like, okay. That's right, that's right. And also sometimes it is kind of, you know, chicken egg thing. But they do go around, and that's why sometimes in the beginning, that's why everybody says in the beginning of the path is very difficult. Because, you know, if you don't have mindfulness, then you're not very restrained. But you're not really strength, your mindfulness is even more blue, so you do more things to cause more distractions. And it goes around and around like that. And that's why we're stuck in this cycle of, you know, birth, old age, sickness, and death. Because we don't have the mindfulness to do things that are good for us. You know, we run after sense pleasure, because we think that's what happiness is. And then we suffer. And then, you know, and then the more we suffer, the more we want happiness. But the only happiness we know is in the five sense world. So we go run it again. And then we get burned, and then we, you know, get more confused, but run back to the five sense pleasure. And it goes round and round until finally you meet the right teacher, you have the conditions come together somehow, and then you realize, ah, okay, actually I'm going the wrong way. I'm going to go the other way somehow by just kind of limiting my five sense world pleasure long enough for the power of the mind to come up. And that's why the first 5-10 years of a monk life, it sometimes can be very difficult when the mind hasn't come together. Because, like I said, you know, in the monk's life, there's plenty of suffering if your meditation is not getting together. Because not only you don't have the five sense pleasure, you know, no eating afternoon, you know, not too much distraction, not too much entertainment. So you're sitting there, you know, worse than prison. What I used to think when I was a young monk, it's like terrible. You know, no meal, prisoners, they have videos, and they have music, they can talk to each other. And I was like, I'm sitting here stuck in the Thai forest, nothing. One set of robes, not too much entertainment. And I think, what I do to deserve this? So in the beginning, there's plenty of suffering in that way. But, you know, what pull most monks through is faith. Faith that you are doing the right thing. And as in Charleston, you are meant to suffering. But it's not you that's suffering. It's your defilements. It's your craving that's suffering. Because you're not getting what you want. You're not getting the hit of the five sense world that you would normally get. The hit of eating what you want, talking to whoever you want, you know, hanging out with your friends. You know, in the monastery, you're stuck between, you know, the two people that you're dating with. And sometimes they're not really your friends. You don't have too much in common with them. You're saying, ah, I wish I could sit there instead. I don't want to sit here. But that's just the nature. And that's why the training works, because it slowly strips away the wanting mind, the controlling mind. And after a while, you have enough kind of mindfulness and strength that comes up. Ah, okay. This is where happiness is. It's in the surrendering, the letting go. They're not wanting, wishing. Right. And that's where happiness comes. And then when that starts to generate a positive feedback loop, the more mindful you are, the more happy you are. And the more happy you are, you don't have to seek outside distraction. You don't have to go and talk to your friends anymore. You don't have to, you know, look for nice food. But that's not where your happiness lies. Yeah. But it's true, you have to start with sense restraint, or sense restraint has to begin somewhere. And then, the next one, the fifth cause is, he has learned much, the monk remembers what he has learned, and consolidates what he has learned. Such teachings as are good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing, and which affirms a holy life that is perfectly complete and pure. Such teachings as these, he has learned much of, memorized, recited verbally, investigated with the mind, and penetrated well by view. This is the fifth cause and condition for obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the holy life. Okay, so still a lot of, you know, still a kind of knowledge, cerebral thing. Thinking, contemplating, investigating, memorizing. But the next thing you have to put into practice. He is energetic. He lives with energy set upon the abandoning of everything unwholesome. and the acquiring of everything wholesome, he is steadfast and strong in his effort, not shirking his task in regard to wholesome qualities. This is the sixth cause and condition for obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the holy life. When he is in the midst of the Sangha, he does not engage in rambling and pointless talk. Either he himself speaks on the Dhamma, or he requests others to do so, or he does not slight noble silence. This is the seventh cause and condition for obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the holy life. Then he goes further. He dwells contemplating rise and fall in the five aggregates, subject to clinging. Such is form, such is arising, such is passing away, such is feeling, such is perception, such are volitional formations, such is consciousness. Just to know that it's arising and it's passing away. This is the eighth cause and condition for obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the holy life. And this is more subtle Dhamma. You know, apparently with the, you know, meditation masters, that's what they said. Once you reach a certain point, and that's the only thing that comes up to your mind. You know things are rising, they stay for a while and they go away. You know, all mental phenomena, all physical phenomena, everything you come into contact with, you have this kind of prism, this lens to look through all your experience. They're there, they stay for a while and they go away, everything. And it sinks really deep and deep into your being. So we all know it, you know, impermanence in a way. But it's when you penetrate through impermanence, then you also penetrate through suffering and non-self. And that's where ultimate liberation lies. It's in the penetration, in the kind of, you're not thinking about Dhamma, you're not contemplating Dhamma. You actually are Dhamma, Ajahn Chah used to say. You know, when you've gone through the path, everything you do is Dhamma. That's why the Buddha says, you see the Dhamma, you see the Buddha, because that's all he does, his conditionality. And you know, obviously, this phrase only makes sense if you're enlightened, you know for yourself. Okay, for these eight reasons, his fellow monks esteem him as one who truly knows and truly sees. And these qualities lead to affection, esteem, concord, and unity. These monks are the eight causes and condition for obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the holy life when it has not been obtained and for bringing about the increase, maturation, and fulfillment by development of the wisdom that has already been obtained. Okay. So that's kind of the point of the sutta. It's just conditionality. The basis, you want the result, you have to put in the right causes. But it's, like I said, easy enough to understand, easy enough to grasp, no tricky Pali grammar to kind of dissect, but it's just kind of put into practice and realizing for ourselves. You know, it's not what you know, but it's how far it's sunk into it. And so I encourage everybody to just to take this away and to contemplate it, to realize it as much as you can, every moment, all your interaction. You want something, you know, when you're unhappy, am I putting the right causes and condition? Always think, you know, think what you have as a goal and reflect. Am I putting the right causes and conditions for these things to happen? You get disappointed, you get unhappy, reflect. What am I doing? What is my contribution to this? Yeah. These are reflections I offer you for today by sharing with the sutta reading, number 126, Bhumicha Sutta. Any questions or comments? Okay, very good. We pay respect to the triple gem.